Here's something you don't hear every day. Russia pushed the U.S. to civil rights and women's rights, and it all stems from the Cold War. Kristen Godsey is a professor of Russia and Eastern European Studies at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of a book, The Red Hangover, Legacies of 20th Century Communism. Kristen, we're talking about this today thanks to your viral New York Times article headline, or not yours, probably the New York Times, Why Women Had Better Sex Under Socialism. Care to explain?
Yeah, well, obviously it was a New York Times headline. The article was really about women's rights, which is something that I've spent about two decades doing research in Eastern Europe, studying, doing interviews and archival research, as well as reading the secondary scholarship, both in the United States and in the region. And so this was an attempt to sort of boil down a lot of information into a very short piece. And apparently it struck a nerve.
Yeah, what's been the reaction?
So it's been a little overwhelming, I have to say. A lot of negative feedback. Obviously, people in the United States, I think particularly in this historical moment that we're living in, don't really want to take the time to sort of have a nuanced understanding of the past. There is a lot of scholarship that's available now because of newly opened archives in Eastern Europe. All those archives that were closed to us for all those years are open now, and people, new scholars, younger scholars, are going in, and rather than just studying political things, they're studying things about everyday life, about, you know, how people went to school and the kind of relationships they had at home and the way that they sort of just operated on a daily basis under a totalitarian system. And so what I was trying to do was bring out this really interesting aspect of that research, which is that there were these really important gains made for women under these regimes.
So what did women enjoy in East Germany?
So in East Germany, which was very progressive on issues of women's rights and also particularly on sexuality, well, they enjoyed a lot of state support for their dual roles as workers and mothers. Now, of course, I'm not going to deny the fact that there was a massive labor shortage after the Second World War, and so the East Germans really needed to incorporate women into the labor force. And other people have also argued that, you know, there wasn't a whole lot to do or a lot to buy. And so, of course, people had a lot more time to spend with their friends or to spend with their lovers. But I do think one of the really key things about Eastern Europe and East Germany in particular is that love and sex and personal relationships were decoupled from economic considerations. So you didn't have to marry for money, you know, you didn't have to be a gold digger, or you didn't have to sell your body for food or medicine, as happens in so many other parts of the world. I think the idea, one of the core ideas of socialism, was that if you made women economically independent, that they would be financially and economically untethered from men, and that would be a form of empowerment. And I think that, you know, all of the research shows that despite the very harsh conditions under which women lived, there was a sense of empowerment under the socialist era. And it's not just in Eastern Europe, obviously, because we can also make similar kinds of arguments about the democratic socialist countries in Northern Europe and Scandinavia.
And I look at some of these aspects that you study and I go, wow, you know, that is remarkable that, you know, Russia, or at least in some places, the communist ideals were able to realize that fully integrating women into society is best for everyone. And it created this, I guess you can't call it an arms race, a women's rights race between America and Russia to who can advance women more, who can advance civil rights more and faster. And that, I like that. I like that. Even if they were pushed because of a competition between governments, not, you know, out of responsibility for equal rights. But some of that has been reversed now. So, I mean, while I see it as a promising aspect of humanity, that even if it's a race between governments, it still happened. But a lot of it's been reversed today.
Right. And, you know, the evidence for the arms race between the Soviet Union and the United States on women's rights is very clear when you look at the 1961 executive order signed by President Kennedy to establish the first commission on American women. And it's really clear in the preamble to that executive order that Kennedy is responding to the Cold War, because he cites national security concerns for why we need to pay attention to women's issues. It's really rather fascinating, because the United States, after the launch of Sputnik in 1957, was really worried that the reason that the Soviets were getting ahead of us in science was because they were educating their women, and they basically had sort of doubled the brain power. And Kennedy had gone to Harvard, and he saw all those smart girls at Radcliffe who graduated to become housewives. And he was really concerned that we were losing the human capital of these women. So it's really interesting. And the International Women's Year in 1975 is also the result of Cold War competition, as is CEDAW, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. So it is really important to recognize that the Cold War was productive for women's rights in a way. And yeah, I think, you know, you're absolutely right. There is perhaps an argument to be made that without the kind of pressure cooker of superpower rivalry, some of our civil rights, some of our, you know, dedication to equality has eroded in this country.
It strikes me that with your background, you might be in a great position to inform the newest wave of women's rights movement, the Women's March, on what direction feminism should be going today. Do you have any advice in that vein?
Well, I mean, I definitely think that there has to be a movement. It can't just be all hacktivism. You know, it can't just be all on blogs or on Twitter. I do think, you know, one of the most important things that sort of second wave feminists in this country did, and, you know, for all the critiques of that movement, which some of which are quite valid, but they had this thing called consciousness raising. And that meant a bunch of women got together and sat around in a room over coffee or whatever, and they just talked about their lives and the struggles that they face in their day-to-day lives over sexism, over racism, over, you know, sort of economic disadvantage, lack of education, and so on and so forth. And there was a sense in which that kind of real grassroots coalition building between women, I guess they're called meetups now, were really quite effective, I think. And yes, the Women's March was an amazing moment, but I think that in order for it to be sustained, it can't just be done virtually. It actually needs to be done, you know, on a human basis. That's the way that you build a movement. And unfortunately, I mean, yeah, everybody's busy. I get that. We all have so much going on in our lives. But, you know, young people, I think, are fired up and have energy. And I think, you know, as you have pointed out quite rightly, there has been an erosion of women's rights. And so if you want to prevent the tide, there's got to be some sort of organization on the ground. That's what's so great about democracy, is the ability of people to assemble and to organize. And it's a shame that we've sort of abdicated that.
Interesting, to say the least. Kristen Godsey is a professor of Russia and Eastern European Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, and her book, Red Hangover, Legacies of 20th Century Communism. Thank you, Kristen.
Thank you so much for having me.